Confusion matrix.
We are rolling. Hello again, Pete, and a happy Wednesday, but also a happy belated 70th birthday.
Yeah, weekend, yeah, something like that. Yeah, 75. Yeah. Apparently, the dumb thing is to stick some arbitrary number 29. Somebody said, "Oh, what, 45 again?" I was like, "Cheeky."
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm forever 14, and that's just because I'm immature, but I like fart jokes or whatever.
Yeah.
Good. Well, was it a good weekend? A good birthday weekend?
Well, it was good. In a very casual way, and man of my years, and the sun was out. I mean, it's global warming and all that. Definitely end of April. Yeah, because you tend to remember your birthday kind of time. I mean, normally April's bright and stuff, but sitting in the garden or whatever at 24 degrees, I'm like, this is highly unusual.
Well, have you based that on hard data, Pete, or
No.
Just your faultless memory?
It's my faultless memory. Obviously, when I was seven, everything was much hotter,
Yes, indeed, back in the last ice age. Right, well, we're going to come back to exactly this point,
yeah.
But let's not get railroaded before we start. What do you got for us today?
It was kind of a small point, a bit of musing, really. Something that came up a few times, I think just via some podcasts I was listening to, but it's one of those, rule of three. You hear it in one place and you hear it in two others. And it was just literally the comment of small data. And it was specifically around, I think it was the CEO of a company called Mother Duck, which is quite a funny title. And their actual website is quite good. And they are a cloud layer that sits over DuckDB, which is a versatile...
in memory
database, and it has lots of sort of adjectives as to how good it is at stuff, so that's all good. What I really liked was, I think this guy was actually previously worked in Google, and he was talking about how everybody jumped on the big data train. If we go back to the sort of 2012 2015 sort of era, that's really what it was all about. It was let's get big data. If you get, look how many zillions of rows there are. And of course, this was like the real rise of people like Amazon and Facebook and Google, and really beginning to release quite a lot of code and, dare I say, insights as to how they build stuff. And they were releasing a lot into open source and all of that. And the move was very much, let's do this for our company. Oh crap, you're not going to be able to run that because you're going to need terabytes, petabytes, zigabytes of data. And then there was a whole sort of thrust for a few years of big data, and here's the infrastructure you'll need and all of that, without much thought as to whether we'll get any insights from it. And his realization, 10 years on, was that actually you can do quite a lot with small data. And as obviously machines have got more powerful, and also with the realization that companies have that perhaps they don't have the data on the scale of Google and Netflix, and perhaps they don't really need an infrastructure as a store of that. And then from our point of view, and I know this is what we touched on before, and I thought it was just worth running over again because it kind of gone quiet. I've not seen much else about small data, but is that really most even large companies, traditional companies, might have a lot of customers and so forth, but unless you're born in the kind of modern digital era with networking effects, you probably haven't got 5 million customers. You might have 5,000 or 20,000, but not many companies, have 50 million or, dare I say, 2.5 billion. And so on the one hand, people might think, well, if I don't have that much data and that many clients, well, I'm not really going to be able to get much insight from my data. And I think what we find is exactly the opposite. You can actually get a lot of insight without a lot of data. But, you know, there are definitely some caveats there. So, yeah, so that just occurred to me, you know, again, that's the realm we sit in, sort of small data, and you can do a lot with less.
So I remember the prior employer of ours, a rather large, well-known consultancy / accountancy, we had one of their senior partners was directing our analysis efforts, and we're trying to understand the sort of propensities of their bigger clients. And I said to him, you're going to struggle to get any meaningful insight for this, because ultimately there's not a lot of data, i.e. there's not that many clients despite the size of the business. And I was like, you know, you're not Netflix, right? You don't have billions of viewers across thousands of programs. And he really took that on board, and he would repeat that everywhere in, you know, the most senior levels. Like, he just took it and ran with it, which is a mixed blessing, it turned out. But a company like that is, I mean, it's huge, right? They're a very big company. I'm not going to say who, but it wouldn't be hard to find out. But they don't do much stuff. You know, everything they do is big. Or the majority of what they do, what takes up their employees' time, is big. And so, no, it doesn't generate a lot of data. And we were spending all our time with CSVs and spreadsheets and stuff, which was a sort of really a reflection of that. And I back in the day, as you say, the 2010s, I think people were right to start to say, let's record everything, right?
Wow.
Don't throw any data away. And as a hoarder like me, I'm very sympathetic to that. And as storage got cheaper, you can just store this you squirrel it away on a RAID array or something somewhere. You don't have to do anything with it, but it's there if you want it. But the majority of the data that people needed to operate their business is not big at all. Right. And it's already getting rolled up via your, you know, digital analytics tools or whatever. And that's what most people need. And so I think we got to this point where people were like, well, I've got my Hadoops. You know what I mean? I've got my huge distributed data. You know, can we run a query over that, please? Oh, certainly, sir. That will take 2 weeks. And at which point, thinking, I don't care that much, actually. Look, my Tableau dashboard tells me X, right? That'll do. I can steer my business by that. And a lot of the business users saying, well, that big Hadoop entity there is costing, you know, the data lake is costing me N million, and we're not doing anything with it. Why am I paying for that when I could put that into marketing or whatever?
Wow.
And I get all the data I need elsewhere. And they're quite right to question it. And so I think the idea that you can squirrel stuff away as text files on disks, I still think that's a good idea. Most of that data will be useless. By all means, delete it. And certainly stuff like GDPR will mandate that you do. But you're not going to be wrestling with that. And then once we got into the realm of AWS, Azure, and Elastic Scaling, it sort of brings that stuff back into play, but not as big data per se. Is that while we squirreled all away those customer behavior records that we didn't know what to do with, someone's just asked a question whereby we could really do with analyzing that. So the first step is you take a sample and you're in small data world, right?
Yeah.
Figure out whether that data can yield the insight that you're after. Yes, it can. What do I do now? Well, I spin up an Elastic Scaling cluster on whatever my platform of choice is, run the calculation for a few hours, get the results, shut it all back down again, delete the data, and compress it and put it back where you found it, right? And that operation was probably very cheap. And so I think we've kind of been a bit full circle here in that you don't need a data lake, but that doesn't mean to say you don't need to collect the data. It just means you don't need to orchestrate it or organize it necessarily outside of just making sure it's there. Well, and that, you know, the majority of the analysis you're going to do is not going to need that, but don't rule out never needing it. And also, now when you do need it, the technology is all there to ramp up, do what you need, and then put it away again. So don't stick it in a relational database, don't Hadoopify it, just store it in text files somewhere compressed and let it gather dust.
Yeah. And that small data way into it was something else that you know, it made me think about, because, you know, like you say, you do your analysis on something small, and there will be limitations there, right? Especially around customers. You might have a, you know, what's considered to be a, you know, depending on your sort of customer. If you've got business customers, you know, if you're knocking 5,000-10,000 clients, you know, that's quite a lot, for a lot of even large companies, you know, and some companies will have decidedly less. You can still get good insight from that. But if you start slicing and dicing that, you know, I'm thinking of something like a recommendation engine. If you are Netflix, or even a supermarket to an extent, where you probably have got millions of customers, then you can do quite a good recommendation because you've got a lot of people buying a lot of stuff, and whoever buys this buys that. And that's some of the early data mining they did. I found out everybody buys bananas with everything, so it kind of ruins that insight. But if you've got, you know, only a few thousand customers, and also if you have a broad business, you're doing lots of different things, and of course you've got customers over here that only do this sort of thing, customers over here that only do that sort of thing. Next thing you know, you slice that down and you start dicing it up, and oh, well, what service did they buy? It looks like this. What service did they then go on to? And, you know, it slices down, and next thing you know, you've got, you know, a cohort of three, and is not enough to suddenly say, oh, well, these three clients of ours did it this way, so this other 300 are likely to be the same, you know, which is just like, well, yeah, that's not really any good. So your lack of data, I think, really is a problem there. But the flip side is, like you say, if you go in with the small amount of data, you start doing something, you're working out whether you can do it. And sometimes you run into that limitation. Well, look, I could do this analysis here, but quite frankly, we don't have enough data. And that could be an indication that, look, we could get this data. We have it. We're just not storing it, like you say. And so that can, you know, by doing the analysis of the small data, that can be the way in to decide whether you need to be doing some, you know, big data storage and mining that down the line. So I think, you know, there are two good things that come out of that, and the small data is always the way in, which is what I like.
I mean, I think because I prefer small data, right? And it all got a bit like Tim the Toolman Taylor, you know, more power. and literally, you know, we can store anything and we can analyze anything. And just, sure, of course, why not? Fuck it. But like, do you really need to? And I don't like dealing with big data. It's slow, and you're constantly having to, you know, noodle around with memory, and you have to spend so much time planning, and before you can execute, and then it's all very messy and distributed, and writing queries for distributing computing like Spark. Well, and I just don't want to deal with any of that crap. I just want to get the answers. I'm not in this for the technology. I'm in this for the insight, right?
Yeah.
The technology is just an incidental for me. I'd prefer to be using the best stuff. But if I don't have to distribute this, I'm not going to, right? I'll figure out a way to not have to before I even consider that. And it's just so much more agile. It's so much more fun and responsive. And I'm not good at planning, as would be noted by anyone who's ever met me for more than 2 seconds. Yeah. And I don't, that's not interesting to me, right? I like to come up with things, test a hypothesis, figure things out really quick and dirty, and iterate and evolve really quickly. That's how I want to work. And big data is not conducive to that.
Yeah, agreed. All right, so that's our limit right. Offering for big data.
Yes. Yes, screw big data. We like it small. So next. So I thought about what I wanted to talk about, and I wrote some stuff down on a bit of paper because I wasn't, I can't really be encapsulated in a pithy title. And quite frankly, it's quite possible that I don't know what I want to talk about, which is what the actual problem is. But what I wrote down on this bit of paper is, and I'll read it out verbatim, confirmation bias, bad data, curiosity, scratching itches, asking the right questions, asking the hard questions, with hard in capital letters underlined. I've got opinions versus fact, which has been circled. And there's an arrow from confirmation bias pointing to the letters RFK, right? Uh-huh. So your job is to try and figure out what it is I'm talking about. Go. I can probably provide a little bit more context here.
Yeah.
Because that pretty much covers everything we do. So I was listening to Malcolm Gladwell's Revisionist History podcast.
Oh yeah.
Which is usually very good. Actually, it's worth going back to the beginning. It's not been so good recently. I didn't think, but he's done a couple of excellent episodes on Robert F. Kennedy, the current. I don't know what they call it, is a health secretary or something under Trump in the US. You don't have to scratch very far below the surface to observe that he's a total nutter. And I don't think that's controversial or political, really, either. He's a complete wing nut, right? And he runs that the whole sort of science and health side of things purely on conspiracy theories, and there's a lot of conversation about, you know, he really hates Dr. Anthony Fauci. Is it Anthony Fauci? Dr. Fauci, the prior science guy in Trump's previous regime when coronavirus was entertaining everyone, and he really hates Fauci, like, with all his being. And he's taken some data that seems to contradict the fact that one of these vaccines is effective. He's basically saying it causes more adverse effects than it does save lives. And this is, I can't remember the virus, but it's one of these infant vomiting viruses that used to kill, you know, babies constantly, right? And now it's been eradicated. And he's like, yeah, but it doesn't work, mate, because I don't believe in vaccines. And he's gone after this. And Fauci's written a paper where he said, basically, most of the babies that died of this thing didn't die of this thing, right? They died of other things, right? And RFK seems to have conflated these things in his head, and he thinks that Fauci, for once, is agreeing with him, right? But that's not what Fauci's saying, right? Yeah. It's essentially the whole point is that if you get hit by a car and you die in hospital later, you die of a, you know, some sort of brain injury or whatever from being hit by that car. You don't say, oh, it wasn't the car that killed you. It was the brain injury, right? Well, yeah, but the car caused the brain injury, right? And so that gets logged as a death by an accident, right? But by a traffic accident. And the same goes for things like coronavirus and anything else like that. I mean, you don't die of cancer, you die because your heart stops, right? And what he was saying is that what happened was effectively that the immune system was so eroded by things like dehydration and stuff caused by the vomiting virus that they tended to die of other things, right? Like things like the cold or whatever, right? Because they just simply couldn't defend themselves. The same goes to things like AIDS, right? But Fauci's taking this as going, no, he's agreeing with me that the vaccine kills more than it saves, which is so far from the truth, it's not even funny. And he it's just basic confirmation bias. Because actually, the data that he's put in his book, because he wrote a whole book that might as well be titled "Why I Hate Fauci," he seems to have just read the wrong column, right? In the data, right? That supports, it's effectively the packaging-laid data that shows the effectiveness of it, but also the adverse events, right? And actually, I think what he's read is the things that I think the adverse events, maybe. He's got it wrong. It's worth going to listen to it because, funny enough, Gladwell does a better job than me at explaining this. But this is, I was just sort of thinking about this. And then the second episode is about an interview that he'd done with Joe Rogan, where he brings this up. And Rogan just takes it on face value and just like, audible tuck going, the deep state are at it again, right? And it's all wrong. And Rogan doesn't even question this, right? He just, yeah, of course you're right, mate. You're RFK. Yeah. And it's just all this stuff in terms of opinions driving analysis. And I had a similar thing. I mean, I had to explain to someone why I audibly wince when I hear an analyst going, yeah, but it never happens like that. Or yeah, but our customers don't do that. Or yeah, but our margin is always something, right? And I'm like, where's your evidence, right? Well, we haven't done the analysis yet, right? Well, why are you telling me that you've got an opinion? And it's like, well, why does this matter, right? Why does this matter that you're expressing an opinion before you've done your homework? And this is not a hypothesis. It's an opinion. A hypothesis would be saying, but what if customers were doing this, right? You know what I mean? But this is, no, it's never like that. But we'll do the analysis. I'll, pat you on the head and say, yeah, I'll humor you because you pay me. But like, I know what the answer is going to be. And so why is this a problem? Why would I visibly wince when something like this happens? It's because you've basically biased yourself. Because if you're wrong, then you have to go back to that customer and say, oh yes, Oz, I was wrong. Right?
Yeah.
And people don't like doing that. And so automatically you put yourself in a slightly awkward confirmation bias mode.
Yeah.
And you're likely to be less inquisitive, and it's just like you're painting yourself into a corner needlessly. And I'm not saying this from a position of ultimate, information chastity and, that I'm the best. The reason I can say this is because I've done it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I've done it and I've been burned and I'm now super cautious. It's like, well, what do you think, Alex? I don't know what I think. Right. Either I've done the analysis or I haven't. I'm going to go and do it. It's going to take me X days to do this. Mm-hmm. I'll let you know. But what I can tell you is it can be done. Right. And that's about as far as I'm going right now. The outcome is what it is.
Yeah.
And I think people, sometimes business people hate that because they just want now, answers, answers, answers. You spend your whole day looking at the data. You must know, I've got my suspicions, but I'm going to go and see what the data says because I've got this wrong before.
Yeah.
So let's go look. And I guess that's really what this random bunch of words is pointing towards. And I think just before this, started recording this, you were also mentioning about reproducibility as well.
Yeah.
So it seemed like a good thing to talk about.
Yeah, I definitely. I mean, there's so much to unpack there. I mean, when you read out the list at the beginning, my thought was, well, that's just a list of humans, right? And because these are the challenges that we come up against so much. And it's interesting, so as humans, we do actually have biases. It's just the way our brains work. And there's no getting around that. And I think you can adjust for it in certain ways. But even doing that, people don't like. And the example I've got is exactly like you say, you know, we're obviously, we work in data, we're going to be super conscious of when an opinion might fall down. And the classic one, massively for humans, and this creates a whole bunch of other biases, is the whole fallacy of perfect memory. You know, and I'm always saying to my family, you know, when they say, oh, no, I definitely did X. And I'm like, well, that's what you believe you did, and that is your memory. But as we know, memory is faulty, and they usually throw stuff at me.
People hate that.
I know, exactly.
They hate it. You might as well just say, oh, you know, you've got like a tiny, small little brain. You know, like literally they take it as a slur.
Yeah.
Right? When what you're saying is you're pointing out a fact, right?
Exactly.
It's no different from saying, well, you're 5'7".
Yeah.
Well, how dare you call me 5'7"? But no, here's a tape measure. You really are. You know, it's like, this is a fact. But people hate it. They really get
And it's totally crazy. But part of the reason why I do it is I always think I'm giving them a get out of jail free card. Maybe they just see that I'm giving myself one. When I say, oh, no, I definitely put it down there yesterday and I haven't seen it since. But I know my memory is faulty. It's basically giving me a get out. So when I'm wrong I put it somewhere else, but I'd forgotten, I can go, oh, that's so. But I give it to them as well, because so many times I'm like, well, look, I know you can say that. I know I'm going to go out to the shed and I'm going to find it there. And I know that because I saw it there 15 minutes ago. And then you're going to have to backtrack and say, oh, that's right, I must, like, nobody's touched the shovel since you last used it, and I've just seen it in the shed, and you're telling me you left it somewhere, that's magic fairy didn't come along and put this thing away, and I've not touched it, so, you know, you must, I'm giving you a get out to say, oh, well, I know my memory's faulty, so maybe I don't remember doing it, and people will go, right, for the last second, and you go, like, there you go, open shit, there it is. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, right. And let's move on. But I think part of the reason that we do it, as you say, is because we know that, I mean, it's great to have opinions. Can't help it. Again, it's another human trait. But we're also aware that you've got to be flexible. And, you know, and I've been in data and looked at it and started to form an opinion on something. And then you drill down and it either evaporates. And sometimes you try your best to bend the data to your will. And you're like, no, I saw this. This must be right. And then you cut it a certain way and you think, oh, yeah, so all of the bits that I saw that were leaning, trending in this direction were because of this reason. And that is not really what I wanted. That's, yeah, so there is no trend here. The trend was because of this. And we've got to remove that. And, you know, we've been through that.
It's especially hypnotizing when you get into the realms of, well, it stands to reason, doesn't it, mate? It stands to reason that if you do this, then that will happen, or, you know, and you're going in there going, well, you know, that is completely reasonable. Well, but people often take this as almost like a stated fact. Well, I don't really even need to bother looking at the data, right? Because it stands to reason. It's obvious, isn't it, right? And it's really hard to get out of that and to sort of, even psychologically, it has an anchoring effect. And then you go look at it and actually, no, it's either more complicated or it just isn't. You know, it doesn't, you know, it may look on the surface like it should be this way. But if you go and look at it and then you think about it, given this extra context, actually, it's not really the way you say it is. And I know that now, right?
Yeah.
And it's really hard to back off from that when you've really sort of asserted it. And the other issue I've got as well is when you get, you know, old classic, anything said with enough conviction might as well be the truth to most people. You're in that meeting where someone says, look, I want you to go and have a look at this, but quite frankly, I know what the answer is already, and that is X. Then the people, the subordinates in the room, or even more senior people in the room, will start to go off and communicate that. Right, and take actions and strategy off of it, and in the meantime you've gone off and gone, no, it really isn't like that at all, and now a whole bunch of people have got reputations on the line, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And it's like, and strategies have been made and budgets have been allocated and all because someone had an opinion, and I'm like, you get to have your opinion, but remember this. What you've got there is a hypothesis, right? Yeah. You might be right, but like, let's test the hypothesis. And when you state it as a hypothesis, people are much less likely to take action on it.
Yeah. That's the key for me, you know, and hence the memory is fallible, is fine to have the opinion, but you've got to be able to be flexible and backtrack. And like you say, having a firm opinion, which then permeates to the rest of the group into some groupthink, you know, especially from our position where we often come in as, you know, consultant type people into that group. We're outsiders already. And then you start telling them that everything, not everything they believe, but something they believe, which they hold dear and have just assumed and haven't thought much about for 10 years, is an assumption at best. And actually we're showing it that it's not quite right for several reasons, or it's changing. And this is the thing, there's nothing wrong with firmly held beliefs, but how long have you held that? You know, with the world changing, it isn't business changing, with digital changes, something you believed 3 years ago for your business, is that still applicable? Great if it is. But if it's not, and everybody in the room thinks that it is, and we come along and say, oh, it's not, you just get that, well, what do you know? So, well, what I know is what the date is.
Yeah, I think we've heard enough from the experts, you mean, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And it's, it's also Moneyball, right?
Yeah.
Punditry versus data.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's that flexibility. And I think that's, you know, it is one of the harder parts of our role, because what would be really nice is we turn up with the numbers and everyone says, oh, wow, I never realized that. You're fantastic. I definitely believe this. All opinions change. Let's change strategy. Go and do this. But as we know, you know, it lies, as you pointed out, it goes into the human side of things, which then has people thinking, oh, damn, I've been thinking this for a long while. I must have had at least 5 conversations this week. I would be wrong in all of those. Don't want to be wrong in those.
Yeah. Yeah. And what do you do from that point?
Yeah.
And yeah. I think we need to be careful here. I'm always at pains when I go into a business to not besmirch the expertise of the people there. No one's questioning your ability to do your job. You know, you run a business, you're making zillions of dollars a year. You might not have been very data orientated, but you're doing something right. Okay. I mean, mate, you're probably a genius, right? But if you're in the position where you're asking questions of the data, it usually means that something has changed, right? Yeah. Things aren't moving in, you know, the line don't go up anymore, right?
Yeah.
You know, people like us are brought in when a business is in transition, either in a positive sense to go, well, we've reached such heady heights, but there's more, you know, there's more to do here, or, you know, line don't go up. Right. And so can you help me understand why? And so I want to understand what you care about. I want to understand your punditry, right? I want to understand your magic crystal ball and why you think the ways you think. Because that's my starting point for the hypothesis. Well, let's go and look if see if that's still the case. And lo and behold, yes, it used to be, but stuff has changed, right?
Yeah.
And so you need to change your thinking. And it's really important, I think, to structure your interactions with business users in the most sympathetic way possible, and to guide them on a journey to coming to the same conclusion that the data has led you to come to, and to be able to and free to do the analysis without it intrinsically seeming like you're trying to contradict a very successful person in role.
Yes.
And it's a bloody tricky line to balance, that one.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's exactly, you know, that's why the idea of it's the lack of flexibility that really gets me, because like you say, we're often brought in, you know, to create change or when change is happening, and the very nature of change means that you need to be flexible, and which should mean that people are looking to do something different. So having that opinion, which then gets, you know, becomes concrete because of human nature and the nature of groups, is definitely a struggle. And you're absolutely right that really we want to get into that opinion, and ideally we want to be able to model the whole reason that opinion is there through data. You know, and I've, you know, we've both done this a few times, and sometimes it can take quite a while because, you know, things are happening, people have opinions about things, processes have sprung up to cope with issues, then there are processes on processes to cope with the issues that that process created. And then having now run that way for 2-3 years, that's now the way things are done. And it's done, you know, and A means B means C means C. And that all makes sense to me. I work in the business, great. We roll up and we go, well, it doesn't make any sense at all. Can we pull this apart, model that, find the right bits of data, work out, yes, I can see now why that's happening. And once you have those elements, then you can start to tweak those and maybe understand why things are flatlining or why things are going up, and whether that's, whether you can reproduce that. And that's really, you know, kind of what we're after is, great, if you've got that opinion, brilliant. Let's, you know, how can we take those elements and then reproduce it elsewhere? Because, you know, if you're successful in one part of the business, you want to paste that everywhere else, right? If one bit's improving 22% and one improving 2%, surely the guys in the 22% division need to speak to the 2% division. But it's not, you know, it's not always the case. It's just going to copy and paste over and work. So that opinion is so important. Pulling it apart and finding the data elements of it is really good, but it still boils down to, okay, so now we've got the understanding of that. Now we've got to go for some flexibility. And again, this is where our heads are different from everyone else's, because we go, great, if I've held that opinion for ages and I have to put energy into that and convince other people all the time, and now I've got data to back me up, I can actually step away from that, let the data do the talk, and actually go and apply my brain doing something else. But we've seen cases where, you know, we come with the modeling of the data and say, oh, it appears that this is happening, and they say, yeah, absolutely, you're right. And that's why, you know, I just told the board this week, and we see it as a great success. Great. So now you can have this data tell the story for you. And then you suddenly get sidelined because, well, that's their role, right? They're the one in 300 people that can interpret this. What? And you've now given me a way into that, which means that other people could interpret that. Well, I'm not really interested in that, because that's my role, that's what I do. And so again, you get into that human kind of hoarding of knowledge. I've managed to work out the interpretation of this. Not many other people do, so that gives me value. Well, if you've now modeled that, oh dear. Yeah. But what we always say is, great, now you can go and apply your skills to another challenging problem. But people don't
understand. Yeah, go do something less boring instead. Right?
Indeed,
So, right, it's inherent in the type of data science stroke analysis that we do that we are harbingers of change, right? We are agents of change. And therefore, we tend to find ourselves talking a lot about change management, right? And I can see a future episode where we bring one or more guests on that actually are quite experts in change management, because it is an art and a science, and I think it would be a really interesting conversation. But the thing is, businesses are set up to resist change, right? You've got the human element in that humans are not often great and desperately happy with change. But then once you get after over a certain size, sort of out of startup territory, the bureaucracy starts to set in, and the bureaucracy exists to hold things steady, right? To reduce volatility. Uh-huh. If you do it properly, you don't also stifle change and innovation, but it's a really hard thing to do, especially when you know, you get quite entrenched and you're quite successful at what you do, and you almost want to, you know, put the insect in amber, right? You want to freeze things. And as a result, not only when change needs to happen because of, you know, strategy or, you know, external factors, almost everything about the business will resist it, right? And that can happen actively by people just saying, well, screw you, or more often passively, where people go, yeah, great idea, yeah, cool, we'll definitely do that, and then goes off and definitely doesn't, right? Or does it for a bit and goes, yeah, but I don't really think I want to do this, it's not really part of my job, it's not on my scorecard, so I'll just deprioritize that progressively until no one's doing it, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, change management comes into play really, really quickly, because it's not just about, well, X used to be the case, but now Y is. It's about creating a strategy around that and having that strategy implemented. And you often need data to support the rollout of something that, you know, should be obvious, simply because businesses don't like to change. Well, and it might need a different flavor of bureaucracy. It might need a restructuring. It might need all of these things. And yes, they're disruptive. Yes, it's difficult for people. No, I'm not discounting the, you know, the headaches and the real life issues that people are going to have to deal with during that change process. But I'm sorry, guys, it's either that or you're all sacked because the business is going out. You're going down, right?
Wow.
But it's so bloody hard, and we're often at the jagged, bleeding edge of that, because, you know, we come with the bad news. Well, how do we know that we've now got to, you know, restructure this whole department? Well, Alex told me, right? Oh. Alex gave me the data. Blame him, right? I'm just doing what he said. You know. And so we're both, you know, welcomed and thanks for letting us know. Thanks for helping us understand this. And then, like, oh, by the way, we all hate you. Everyone hates you now, but it's fine because you're only a consultant. Bye.
Yeah, definitely. One other thing that was on the list that you mentioned was the sort of hypothesis and reproducibility, which we mentioned a few times. And it's funny because I heard something just the other day where it was on a podcast and they were talking about the, what do they call it? The crisis in reproducibility of theses around social sciences. So, you know, some lot of psychology stuff in the last 10 years when people have gone back and tried to reproduce them and get completely different results. So they were talking a bit about that. And this guy was saying that how he works in the sort of psychology side. And he was saying how quite often now you pre-register your hypotheses, and so they get stored, you know, by an external, you know, sort of third party prior to you starting your research, so that you don't fall into the trap of, well, I want to research around something to do with this, go and get the data, find a whole load of correlations, and then make a hypothesis, and then show that those hypotheses are true, which, of course, in 10 years' time turns out to be not quite the case. It did make me think. I had a sudden pang of guilt where I suddenly thought, God, I'm sure I've done that before. You know, let's get the data, look at the data, and then decide, oh, yeah, what is it we can see? Oh, I must be seeing this. And I think there's an element to that which I think is okay to do, which is, well, we talked a bit about big data earlier. And we've got so much stuff we don't really know. You know, what are the patterns that are in there? But I think, you know, we would still say, you know, we still take a moment to say, given all of this data about X and that no one really knows, what are some of the things that we might expect to see? You know, even if it were, you know, and I think we quite often then say, if it was ideal, what would you see? And if it was rubbish, and I think we sometimes we scribble it down, certainly, you know, we talk about it and at very least have it in our heads. Well, I like to think we do. And, you know, I think when you explore, you know, it's not like we're doing research papers most of the time, so I think that's fine. But, you know, I had that moment where I just thought, well, have I been guilty about this? But You mentioned as well earlier about, you know, people realizing that you should write something down first. And it kind of goes back to that business knowledge point, which is where if you have an opinion about something, that's worthwhile. That, let's get that down as a hypothesis. We'll go and look for that and see if we can back that up to prove it, or whether the data doesn't prove that. And that's, you know, and hence flexibility. So that reproducibility, that getting something down first, I think, again, is just a way we tend to start thinking, rather than, you know, how many times have people come to us and said, oh, here's some data, can you tell me what it shows you? And he's like, well, don't show me anything. What do you want it to show me? You know, and even if it's a desire, it's better for you to say, oh, here's this data. I want it to show me that our top 10% customers live in this area. Well, great. At least that's our hypothesis. And then when I show you that that's not true, then fine. But don't just say, oh, you know, tell me what it shows you. Well, what are you thinking? Ah, that's for you to work out. Tell me what the data says and I'll tell you what I was thinking. Well, that doesn't really work that way.
I mean, I think you're always start. I mean, like, yeah, the tell me what the data tells me line is, I hear that less and less these days as people get more data literate.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the moment you're starting to peer in the data, even if you're doing fairly open exploratory analysis, it comes with some sort of hypothesis. It's, you know, it's like, well, margins are down, right? Well, why do you think that is? Not a bloody clue. But it's in here somewhere in this slot of data, right, about margins. And it's like, well, okay, fine. I don't mind that type of brief because, you know, I get it. I understand that you don't know. But, you know, you need to do that quite quickly and you need to pull out some features of the data that look significant and play that back to the client as soon as possible. Because that's when the hypothesis start to come. Oh, that's interesting you've shown me this. That gets me thinking, well, maybe the problem is over here, right? And you're going, yes, right, let's go and find out, right? And so, you know, usually you've got something. But this idea that you post-hypothesize, you know, I know we probably do it. to a degree, I think it's hard not to. And I think, you know, everyone should be required to read Thinking Fast and Slow by Kahneman and Tversky, you know, at least once a decade, right, to remind themselves that we're all, you know, we're built to be fallible, right?
Uh-huh.
And you know, I'm sure we do, but, you know, part of what it is that qualifies us to do our job is to be able to and to routinely reshape conversations to be focused around hypotheses and questions and to have that discipline. And as we were saying earlier on, people hate it, right? Yeah. You become a bit of a stick in the mud because people just want, you know, well, we think it's this, so we're just going to go and do this thing. You're just slowing us down. I'm like, well, maybe, but, you know, if you get this wrong, you know, it's going to take you a lot longer to recover. Right. And you know, we tend to be the messenger that gets shot and we also look like we're total pedants. Well, right. But I just can't see how else we do our job. It becomes a communication issue because there's no way around it. I can fabricate data for you. I'm just not going to. You're asking me to do my job badly. Right. Which is not something I'm going to do. Right.
Yeah.
You've asked me to do a job. You want to look at data because you want to know what reality looks like. I'm afraid that the reality contradicts what you want reality to be. So you can be an RFK in there and go, well, I don't care. This is what I think. I've got these two blokes I met down the pub that tell me this other thing is true and that this vaccine doesn't actually work. And that's what I'm running with, right?
Uh-huh.
And in some senses, at least he's honest about it. You know what I mean? I think it's a thinly veiled, I don't really care what you think, experts. You know, by the definition of our job, we can't be that. Otherwise, we would not. I mean, what's the point? I can build you I can get ChatGPT to build you a random number generator. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A plausible a plausible random number generator that gives you, you know, you can give it any description and it will come out with some sort of plausible set of numbers for it. And I'm certain you can just do it, right?
Yeah.
And then by definition, since it comes from a large language model, it will be dubious. And so, you know, box tick there. But in the meantime, I'm just, you know, if you ask me to get the reality out of the data, that's what I'm going to do. And I'm sorry if you don't like it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and I think, like you say, the Kahneman stuff, I mean, is just to realize that we're all subject to a whole bunch of biases, some of which we may be aware of and some not. And I think it's just, you know, build that into your process and have a, you know, a mental or a written down checklist that just, you know, reminds us that, you know, when you're going down a rabbit hole, or not necessarily a false assumption, you know, but when your bias is really kicking in, and have that little checklist, which is, okay, am I succumbing to a really extreme bias? You know, and it's like you say, you know, and that's really how people run businesses. And this is how I always like to see this around strategies. Like you're going down a path, you're making a change, and you really should be able to have, you know, some strategy in there that says, and here are our measures, here are the steps, the improvements we're looking to get each step along the way. And if we don't get those, what's our action going to be? And this is where you see it a lot less, because that's quite a bit of work, right? Well, we've got three paths here. We've got our 20% growth, we've got 10% growth, and then we've got zero or negative growth. And let's measure that every 2 months. And report back. And we know when people start measuring that, well, when they're a bit below, well, no one wants to give bad news, right? So then you're back into the whole human cycle again, where we'll start to, oh, sorry, I haven't got the numbers this month. You know, they're a bit late coming because, you know, they're not hitting their target. But really what you should be doing is, well, we've got a 20% target, and up front we're saying, well, you know, anything 15% to 20% is acceptable. If it's below 15, then we should do X, review these things. And, you know, obviously try and work out why. But, you know, if it's down in the doldrums and you're only improving like 3%, then, you know, obviously you still understand why. But perhaps you've got a different set of actions you should take. And thinking out those actions up front starts to remove some of that human, oh, well, I don't want to show you these are really bad news. Well, we've got a plan if it's really bad. Because what you don't want to get into is, well, we can't tell if it's bad until, you know, after 12 months. Well, that's just not true. Yeah, you can be measuring this every quarter. And you can maybe say after the first quarter, well, we wouldn't have expected these numbers to go up quite so aggressively. In which case, you've got a question which says, well, why does the target say that? You know, and I think they're all valuable and worthwhile discussions to have. And I think some of the problems is that those plans aren't there. So, oh, you're going to hit this target. Or what if I don't? Well, you will. And then you get there and you don't. So what do you do? Now we're having a discussion about it. Well, that's, you know, you're already too late, right? So,
well, we're going to stray into the realms of self-fulfilling prophecies. And when you measure something, you change it and all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And I think this is so core to everything we do. Mm. I think we want to come back to it.
Yeah.
I think we're going to come back to it a lot if I'm right. But I did want to just put a slight counterpoint to this, mm-hmm. which is that these biases in the broader sense exist for a reason. They're like heuristics, they're shortcuts.
Yeah.
They're ways we can make sense of the world quickly. And function without having to process every bit of information, and they're really helpful. And in fact, they only, you know, they're only bad when they go wrong or they get applied wrong or you get, you know, caught in a loop. But the flip side to it is that, and this is why I had scratching itches written down on my list. It had nothing to do with any, you know, infections or anything. It's the spidey sense. And so I was looking at this, just some sort of sales volume data the other day, and it just didn't look right. My spidey sense was tingling, and I was just like, something's not right here. And I've just, I don't have the answer to this yet, but, you know, I couldn't not scratch it. It wasn't necessarily what I was supposed to be looking at, and other people couldn't see it, right? They couldn't see what I was talking about. I'm like, this is not right. Something's not right here, right? And it goes very much towards, you know, following your instincts and working with some of those biases, because sometimes they're right. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But you've just got to be disciplined about it. You've got to be disciplined and say, you know, inform the hypothesis. So what is the case here? Right, well, I've got a hypothesis about why this is the way it is, or at the very least, a hypothesis is to so I can show, you know, I can shed some light on what's going on here to create some hypotheses, right? But, you know, no one else was looking at this, right? I'm just looking at it going, that doesn't look right. And I would struggle to describe it, but I'm like, no, there's something wrong here. And maybe it's nothing, but I also have a responsibility to act on that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very much, you know, we're all subject to these biases, and like you say, they're useful heuristics. It's not to say they're wrong. It's just, you know, the more aware you are of different ones, then you can use it. You can make that shortcut. At some point down the line, it's useful to circle back round and see if that shortcut was, correct and getting you to the right place or not. I mean, you hear this right about conspiracy theories. You know, sometimes a really wacky conspiracy theory turns out to be right. So it's not that, that they're always wrong. And, you know, some might argue that, you know, conspiracy thing is a little, you know, heuristics to get to a much simpler answer, or sometimes a much more complex answer than what's really there. And sometimes there's some truth to them, and like you say, that can be useful. And of course, it makes you look great if you're the first one there and then you get proven right 5 years later. But again, it's that flexibility to say, okay, well, I did get there for this reason. Is that reproducible in other problems? And you'll see from conspiracy theories that no, often it isn't, and that's where you end up with them, because, you know, it's like, well, it worked here, must work over when I look at this part of the government. Yeah, not really. And so
I mean, it basically, the Occam's razor isn't always effective, right? But it's pretty good, and it, in itself, it is a shortcut. You know what I mean? Because you can just say, that sounds too complicated, so I'm not going to pursue that. Right. Well, that's wrong. Right. That's the wrong thing to do. You know, if you're able to figure out what the right answer is, you should find the right answer. But so, supposedly unbiased people who waft around things like Occam's razor, as you point out, it is the same fallacy. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you really do believe that you are an objective player, then you should test your own hypotheses, right?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. And maybe that pun of Occam's razor being a shortcut is a good place to end.
I'm a poet and I don't know it. I do love a good pun. I know I feel like I say this at the end of every episode. I have so much more to say on this. And I do want to talk more about change management. I'd like to have a conversation about The Big Short, and how cases like that start to shed light on things like observing something changes it, or the opposite, right? And also there's a conversation about Moneyball too. Right?
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, definitely.
So we're not going to shut this podcast down for a lack of things to talk about. I think
Exactly.
In the meantime, I'm going to go off and continue to be perfect and scratch all my itches.
Yeah.
So I think we're done for the day.
Yeah.
I'll see you next week.
Yeah.
Enjoy the sun.
Yeah. Yeah. And you. Yeah. Cheers, everyone.
The confusion matrix.